Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is the 10th of 11 conversations with former Secretary of State George P. Shultz. In this discussion, originally recorded in 2006, Shultz and previous Nobel laureate winner Gary Becker discuss a variety of topics from the International Monetary Fund and World Trade Organization to immigration and energy policies. The two discuss Shultz's thoughts at the time about what should be done in several of these fields from a political and economic standpoint. We hope you enjoy this week's episode, and be sure to stop by each week for a new episode of the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
All right, George, I know you've been interested in the IMF and the World Bank and have not been very happy with the way the IMF has performed, and maybe also the World Bank. Could you let me know a little bit about what your views are on that?
The IMF was created to monitor the gold-related fixed rate exchange rate system that was put in place at the end of World War II. And it had certain duties with respect to that. It really wasn't a fixed rate system. The U.S. rate was held and everybody sort of moved their currencies around us, much to our disadvantage, I think. Not very symmetrical at all. But at any rate, that was the IMF's job. When we closed the gold window in 1971, so people couldn't exchange their dollars for gold at $35 an ounce, that system, the Bretton Woods system, basically ended. And we went into the present sort of managed floating system. And so it seemed to me that the IMF's role would be very limited at best. Instead, the IMF proceeded to invent new jobs for itself. And it gradually sort of moved over, almost replicating the World Bank, making loans and encouraging economic development of one thing and another. And so it seemed to me it had lost its way. So in an article I co-authored with Bill Simon, who was my successor as Secretary of the Treasury, and Walt Wriston, who gave us a lot of credibility because he was certainly one of the outstanding, if not the outstanding private banker in that period, calling for its abolition. And I think it did, it stirred people up a lot. And I think it brought a sense of the need for IMF reforms. And there was a commission, Meltzer Commission, that had some good suggestions, I thought. But it's an example of a bureaucracy that started for a reason. It has money, and so it just keeps going, whether the original reason was so or not. I regret something I might have been able to do back in 1972 and 3 when I was Secretary of the Treasury. We developed an approach to reform of the exchange rate system. Right. I might say an approach that was ingenious and the basic idea I got from Milton Friedman. But we produced a flexible exchange rate system in the clothing of a par value system. Yeah. And at that point, I think it might have been to get the IMF to make a big change. Because it always seemed to me, and I think this today, it could be benefited if we did this today, the IMF should be thought of as aligned with the World Trade Organization.
Yeah.
Because the exchange rate system is basically the other side of the coin of the trading rules. And instead of having a World Bank IMF meeting in the sense of these things are the same, they're the same only they each have a bunch of money, you move the IMF with the World Trade Organization and let the World Bank have its meeting with the other development banks around the world and put the IMF in a spot where it has a clearer mission. Oh. So I have been very critical. Yeah, you're right.
We're starting afresh now. Would there be any role at all for an organization like the IMF, even modified, or would we be better off just not having an IMF? And we have the World Trade Organization. What role can the IMF add to what the World Trade Organization does? If we could start afresh, which we're not doing, but well, I suppose we could.
It could add the dimension of watching the exchange, the use of the exchange rate system to distort what might be normal trading patterns. And you remember the beggar my neighbor
right.
policies that many countries followed in the 1930s. They were part of the protectionist atmosphere. So I think that's something that needs to be watched over, and I suppose the IMF could do that, but it does need all that money to do that.
Right. Now, what about the World Bank? You haven't, as far as I know, written a similar article on the World Bank. Do they have a role in the sort of modern global capital markets and developing economy atmosphere? I mean, it seems to me it's questionable, but...
I think so, but I think... If it has a role, its role is with the very poor, the low-income per capita countries. And it seems to me the approach that's now been put in effect by President Bush, and I might say John Taylor, our friend here at Hoover, had a lot to do with this in saying we should judge not by how much money you put in, by what, but rather what kind of results you get out. It sounds perfectly sensible, and it's amazing that that's considered revolutionary.
Right, yeah.
But anyway, do that and say that here is some low-income per capita country, and you just know that if the government is terrible and the policies are terrible, there's no point in putting money in for economic development. Yeah. It just won't be of any use at all.
Absolutely.
But probably there are some occasions where you can see that it could be helpful, and probably it's a good idea to have an organization that operates that way. But the bank still makes big loans to China. China has reserves going out of sight, and they're making loans. Why?
Right.
Because they find they can get a return on the loans.
Yeah.
They get the money. Is that what the World Bank is about?
Right.
The original idea that it was the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development. And the reconstruction was Europe. And the notion was that the private banking world couldn't generate the kind of funds necessary, and so you had to have the World Bank. Well, now the private investing funds are huge, so you don't need to have that.
That mess?
Supplement.
Yeah. Now, what about the notion that, you know, when you have an organization like the World Bank, even in poorer countries, if they come in, particularly if they put any resources in, and that's that they'll delay reform rather than accelerate reform, because you know if you're getting resources from elsewhere, you don't the pressure to reform is weaker. How can one control that tension between aid delaying reform and sort of using aid judiciously to sort of speed up reform?
Well, I think it's a matter of using good judgment about when the aid can really help. And it seems to me a big element of the judgment is deciding that the government you're dealing with is something that can handle it properly. Also, I'm impressed with something different, and I don't know that whether the World Bank has any role in this, but the micro-lending is kind of interesting, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Organizations that set themselves up to loan small amounts of money to people who want to start a small business somewhere. And I described this to my friend Paul Wolfowitz, who now has the job of heading the World Bank, as this is development from the bottom up instead of development from the top down, which always has question marks, I think.
And it was started privately. I
mean, it started privately,
and I think the private ones have been the most successful. Mm-hmm. Let me switch gears to another topic. I know you're interested in energy. U.S. imports maybe 2/3 or so, I think, of our oil. I may be a little off, but I think approximately 2/3.
Over 60%.
Over 60%. And what, if anything, should we be doing to, and the president has recently said that we're addicted to oil. A phrase I like since I've written on addiction. So what do you think we should be doing about, if anything, about our energy policy?
I think we should be working hard to develop alternatives to the use of oil. We should learn how to use less oil. And I put this for me, mostly on a national security foundation. And I think President Eisenhower had that in his mind when he imposed the first quota system. I remember studying, I was asked or assigned by President Nixon to chair a cabinet task force on the oil import control system. And I remember getting a note from Ed Levy, who was then, I think, the president of the University of Chicago. I was on leave from the university. Yeah. The note said, "Dear George, I see you've reformed the Job Corps, and now you're taking on the oil import quota system. What would you like to teach next fall?" So it's a tender subject. But I remember in those days, people would come in when it had the first oil price explosion. By that time, I was Secretary of the Treasury, and it came to us, and people would come with their ideas about alternatives, and you could see there was nothing there. But there's all kinds of things that we could do, and some of them don't call for technology. For instance, we think it would be great, and the president said, to use more mixture of ethanol with gasoline. We know that works. So why not reduce the tariff on ethanol from Brazil?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
And so that doesn't call for any big technological breakthrough. It calls for a political breakthrough. And there's only one politician who has stood up to it, and that's John McCain. Everybody else goes to Iowa, all the presidential candidates, and they all pledge allegiance to this program.
Absolutely.
And McCain said, "I'm not even going to bother with the Iowa program. I think it's a lousy program. I'm not going to go to the Iowa primary. The hell with it." Went on. So I said, hooray.
Yeah, no, that was brave of him to do that. What about raising the tax on gasoline?
Well, if we're going to ration it, and we think it should be rationed, that's the way to go, I think. The mileage restrictions that we use now, they have made an impact, but it's not a very efficient way to go about it. But I don't think that we're ready for a gasoline tax.
Politically, it would be too difficult.
It doesn't seem to be likely.
Yeah, even though we're a really low-taxing country compared to European countries.
But there are lots of things that are developing, many purely private, some generated out of government work, that are making a lot of headway. I drive a hybrid car around the campus. And when I was in China a year or so ago, I had a little meeting. I had a meeting with the premier, me and some other people. And he asked me a question that allowed me to say the following. I said, "It took me roughly 30 minutes to get from the hotel where I'm staying to the place where we're meeting." And my guess is that about a third to 40% of that elapsed time, the car I was in was stopped. And what was it doing? It was idling. Yeah. So it's using gasoline, it's polluting your city, which you're worried about. When I drive my little car around the Stanford campus, every street is a stop street. And the kids on bikes were all over the place. They've got to be ready to stop all the time. And what is my car doing when it's stopped? Nothing. Because the electric motor carries it forward, doesn't have to idle. So all kinds of simple things from that. And if you can get a battery, there's a lot of work being done on batteries now. If you can get a battery to carry a car like that 30 or 40 miles, then your fuel is electricity. And that would make a huge change in our use of oil. But there are a lot of things that people are working on, and I think it should be encouraged as a big national effort.
Now, in the class we give at the University of Chicago, we just had a student gave a report on what would be the U.S. capacity to supply oil and energy at different world prices of oil. And they didn't have to get it up, at least according to their calculation, which seemed pretty well done. They didn't have to get it up that high in order to encourage other sources of oil within U.S. or Canada, let's say safe areas. So maybe market forces, if the price of oil continues to rise, will lead to these alternative methods, including greater use of hybrids. If the price of gasoline rises, greater use of hybrids, a greater incentive to try to invent something else, and they might be able to be fairly effective. But do you think it could come through market forces alone, or do we have to have a more active governmental policy on this?
Well, the Canadians have these huge tar sands deposits.
Tar sands is one of the sources,
that,
absolutely.
Apparently have the equivalent of a Saudi Arabian reserves
right.
in them.
Huge amounts.
It's a higher cost oil right. than Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
And so if you're an investor, you always have to have in your mind, suppose this works, what's going to happen? The price of oil is going to go down. And then the low-cost producer is the one that's able to survive.
Absolutely.
But I think people are calculating now that probably the price is going to stay high enough so that the Canadian tar sands can be productive. I'm all for that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You also have a huge problem in the United States in the politics of allowing the exploration and production of oil and gas. For instance, the absolute no-go off the California coast. But there's
it was
open, like the Gulf of Mexico is. Probably a lot would be found mm-hmm. there and produced there. And there are many other areas in the United States where that's so. And it's even hard to get a terminal for the import of liquefied natural gas,
right.
LNG, to be imported. And that's sort of a no-brainer for us to be able to diversify our supply of gas by being able to draw it from all over the world into LNG terminals.
And refineries, it's hard to get places
hard
to accept
a
refineries.
Refinery sited. That's why when we have something like the storms of Katrina and all this refining capacity, why is it all concentrated in that area? Because it's the only place where people are willing to have one.
So a lot of it is we're causing our problems to some extent.
We're causing our own
problems. We've got to find another way. If we can't change those things, we've got to find another way to offset those problems we're causing.
If you look at it as a market problem, then you have to say the market is circumscribed by these rules about where you can drill. You can't. So there, that is.
Right.
Now, obviously, I think the price goes up, you'll draw more supply in. And that's happening, and that's desirable. But here we are in a war, I believe. We're in a war. Mm-hmm. And Iran is one of our most troublesome enemies. Mm-hmm. So what is happening now? Iran is awash in money. Why? Because the oil prices are way up there, and Venezuela, Washington, and so on. Mm. So my friend Jim Wilsey likes to put it, he said, this is the only war in history where we're financing both sides. And we ought to cut it out.
No, the high price of oil has created a problem for some of the countries that we are not very happy with. There's no question about it, that they have more money to tolerate their poorly performing economies, which aside from the oil, they are poorly performing, like Venezuela or Iran, neither one of them's economy.
It plays right back into what you were talking about earlier, that it's more than foreign aid. It's a suddenly dumping of huge amounts of money on a regime.
Yeah, so I think...
I've been pushing, I'm sure, without success, but anyway, there's a little percolating in Iraq. Let's suppose that somehow the contending sectarian groups are able to form a government and some reasonable stability emerges. Then the Iraqi economy, I think, will probably take off.
Yeah.
But what about taking the money from the oil and putting it into a trust fund, the way it is done in Norway or in Alaska, and then distributing the money to the people of Iraq rather than going to the government, or at least a large fraction of it. So then the government has to justify activities when it imposes a tax, or when it goes to the financial markets to borrow money. You've got to explain, you've got to show that there's a chance of paying it back, whereas when they just get these oil revenues dumped on them, it's comes right out of the blue, and there's no accountability for it.
Well, I mean, we did a study that show that if when the oil, price of oil goes up, the oil producing countries, they keep about 2/3 of it and they give about 1/3 back or so in terms of reduced taxes or not raising other taxes. So it is a windfall.
It's a way in which the ruling people can bribe their population.
The question is, is it easy to get that changed? And that's been the problem.
It's very hard.
Yeah. All right, let me shift gears a little bit. Again, another topic I know you're interested in, demography. I mean, huge things are going on in demography.
Tremendous. Yeah.
And so low birth rates in many European and other countries. What's your view of how that may play out in terms of, you know, not only economy, but other parts of the global world, and particularly the global economy?
I think the evidence is pretty clear that the declines in fertility are likely to persist. We all know that there can be sudden shifts and surprise you, and so these projections that go out a long time, you have to knock on wood and cross your fingers, they may turn out not to be right. But it's pretty clear, you go across all kinds of different cultures, and when women get educated and have a decent chance in the society, and the society has the prospect of rising standards, that the fertility rates go down.
Absolutely.
And they go down drastically. Well, now we're in a world where that's happened in all of the high-income per capita countries, with the possible exception of the United States. Mm-hmm. It's an odd circumstance here. But in the European countries and in Japan, fertility rates are very low. People are living longer. And so you have a complete rearrangement of the demography of their populations. Mm-hmm. And I think it will have an effect on their outlook and what they do and what they're willing to do, their own struggles with how to redistribute income under those mm-hmm. circumstances. And then you see other countries that still have big increases in labor force coming, like China. But China is producing one of the most peculiar demographic right. arrangements. And, right. and they have more boys than girls. A society with a lot more boys than mm-hmm. girls is a pretty unusual society. I don't know how that's going to work.
Yeah.
So you have that to look at. And then you have the Middle East. In Africa, but focus on the Middle East, where birth rates are out of control. Women don't play much of a role in those societies. And so you have a huge number of unemployed young people who have no attachment to work. And so one of the things about work that people don't realize is work attaches you to reality.
Yeah.
And if you don't work, you fantasize. Any nutty conspiracy theory goes, because you don't know how to evaluate it in any realistic way. So I think this is one of the big problems in the Middle East, and it underlies a lot of the instability there and the difficulty of bringing about change. So the demographic facts are very important in trying to figure out what's going to happen, I think.
One of the interesting facts about the Middle East, if I'm not wrong, is in Iran, this country, a fundamentalist country, dictatorial in many ways, very Islamic, birth rates have come down quite a bit. Still, above replacement, well above European, but they've come down quite a bit, which is kind of a puzzle. Because
women have a more of a role in Iran.
So it struck me as puzzling, the economy is doing poorly. And what about migration in general? So usually one thinks here you have European countries, low birth rates, Japan, very low birth rates, aging population, a lot of rich countries, a lot of people want to come to these countries. Of course, most of these countries, if not all of them, don't want to have that many immigrants come in. So
they do and they don't.
How does one resolve that? Because borders are more fluid now. It's hard to keep people out. We have 5 to 10 million illegal immigrants in the United States.
Probably at least 10.
Yeah, and maybe even more. I mean, Europe, I'm sure, has quite a few as well. And you can see the incentives. You have rich countries, there are jobs going available, they can earn a lot more. And countries don't want to punish people just coming to get jobs. So is the immigration going to be one way or another, that's going to bring some kind of resolution to this lower fertility that we see in some of the rich countries?
You're asking me all these questions, Gary. In a normal circumstances, I would be asking you, because you're the guy that's figured out the answer.
No, I don't have the answer. These are too tough. But I know you thought a lot about these questions.
I think if I were able to write an immigration policy for the United States, and it's being struggled at very hard right now, and we'll see. You and I are on a committee to advise Governor Schwarzenegger, and we've been saying to him, you got to have a policy on this, and he's working at it, and he's interested. And our colleague Sebastian Edwards has done some really interesting stuff on this. But I think it's fair enough to say that a country should be able to control its borders. So we should be trying to do that. But we should want to promote the right kind of immigration. And one of the reasons we have all these illegals, so-called, is that we don't have a visa process that works and is able to process things reasonably rapidly. And so people have to stand in line for a year. They take the alternative of coming in illegally. So I think we need to have an entry policy that is clear and allows the numbers of people to come that the market wants to employ. And we should welcome that. And I think that's true at the level of low-skilled work, but also high-skilled work, and we should be welcoming people. Obviously, in this day and age, the post 9/11 world, you work to see that you don't let in people who are anxious to blow things up. But that you can do, and do more quickly than we now do, I think.
So we should allow a lot more legal immigrants.
I think so. Yeah. If you'd say, I mean, there is a market for people. And if there's a very strong market, the market tends to overpower the politics.
Absolutely.
And that's what's happening. Yeah. It happens in the drug field. Yeah. So why not arrange it so that the market's need can be satisfied in a legal way by sizing the numbers you're going to let in appropriately and making the process work more quickly and effectively?
Partly because I don't know if there's a way we can really control the number of illegals unless we open up the legal.
But if we open it up and people come in legally,
then the
illegals don't have any. They don't have a job, so it's not pulling them.
Absolutely.
And they can come through a route that is not so expensive and is much safer. Some of the tales of what goes on at our borders are frightening.
Absolutely. But the paradox is we don't want, we're allowing more people in legally, but we don't want to allow, in terms of U.S. policy, as many people in legally as want to come here, either at the low skill or the high skill level.
Yeah, but let's play that want to come here. But if you say we're going to pay attention to the labor market, we're sort of trying to design a political system that's in line with how the labor market is sizing itself, then you size yourself, and then some people who want to come, maybe they don't want to come if they know there's no market for what they bring.
But take the skilled labor. You know, we have this HB1 program. I think we allow like 70,000 workers in a year now, I think something like that, and that's filled up in like in a month.
Yeah. I mean, well, that shows it isn't enough.
Yeah, it isn't enough. But, you know, there was a couple of years when we were allowing more in because the economy was booming and so on, and the economy's still doing very well. But the pressures I mean, I tried writing something on the blog about why we should allow more, and I was getting all these emails from these people. They said, what do you know, you have a cushy academic job here. We're out there, they're taking away jobs. The political pressures from people who feel that these people are coming in, competing with them for jobs, and they are. I mean, the wage, we know wages get affected when you get more people working at something. And those are hard to overcome. And are we able to overcome that?
At the same time, you have to point to the fact that our unemployment rate is pretty low.
It is definitely.
So yeah. Apparently, there are jobs there. Yeah.
Well, that's what that's how I answer. Now, you mentioned drugs. It's a problem. Well, when you were Secretary of the Treasury, I think we began the war on drugs. Isn't that?
It started
not by you, but
it started in the Nixon administration.
In the Nixon administration, yeah.
Lately.
Yeah.
And Pat Moynihan was counselor to the president. He was a cabinet member in the Nixon administration. And he and I became friends. We worked on one thing and another together. But he was kind of he was not called the drug czar, but he sort of watched this problem. So one day we were on our way to Camp David for a meeting together, and I was busy studying my notes and things. I was going to make a presentation, and he's in an exuberant state. And when Pat was in an exuberant state, it was really obvious. And he said to me, he got my attention, he said, "Schultz, don't you know we had the biggest drug bust in history in Marseille, and it's terrific. We got so many tons of cocaine or whatever it was." And I said, "Congratulations," and I went about my work and annoyed him. So he bothered me and he said, "Don't you realize we've broken the French connection?" That was the where the drugs were supposed to be coming from. And I harumphed again, and he said to me, "Schultz, I suppose you think that as long as there's a big demand for drugs in this country, there will be a supply." And I looked at him and said, "Moynihan, there's hope for you." He tells this story in his couple of his books.
Oh, okay.
And he's by way of saying, yeah, that's true.
So, and it's continued. That's the problem we still have to this day. No matter what we've tried, it just goes, you squeeze in one direction, it's like a dike, it comes in another direction. So is legalization the only real effective alternative? Because it's been a costly program. It's not something that you can say, well, it's not been very expensive for the United States. It has been, I think, expensive in a lot of ways.
Also for other countries.
And for other countries. Involve the disruption of the economies. Is there any alternative to that?
Well, I think there is. I would personally start with a huge education campaign. Basically because I think you observe that drugs harm people.
Yeah, no question.
And driving under the influence harms people. Smoking harms people. And you can say, well, they know that, let them do whatever they want. But I think we should be actively trying to persuade people of the fact that these are very harmful things to their condition. And oftentimes there's a fallout into the society as a result. Should be trying to get people to use, to get off drugs. And if you had a regime where it wasn't so profitable, you wouldn't have an industry there designed to get people addicted.
Absolutely.
I mean, there are people who are selling drugs and they get some kid.
Yeah.
And their whole object is to develop their market. So take that away. So have a big campaign, but then have some sort of controlled but possible way for people to get drugs, much as after Prohibition you had liquor stores that were somewhat regulated. As a way of kind of monitoring what's going on. And then put a lot of emphasis on rehabilitation. The fact that we have our jails full in California and people are talking about building more of them, it's because we arrest so many people for possession of marijuana or something like that. And then they get a jail experience that is bad for them in every way. Be better to have them go into a rehabilitation center and work at it that way, I think. So I'd have a full court press, but I would try to legalize it, I guess you'd say, but in a special way.
Well, you can
not
leave.
Just throw up our hands and say, whatever happened, whatever happens.
No, I agree. Well, but we could legalize and tax it. I mean, so, you know, you can put a tax on it. And so some will go underground. So you try to control that the way we
don't
do.
Put the tax up too high.
Yeah, and you put more punishment for the part that goes underground.
The person you want to punish is the dealer.
Yeah, dealer, absolutely. The dealer. That was the only one I would think. And then you educate at the same time, and maybe the combination can be effective. But certainly the war has been lost. Would you say?
I don't see any prospect of winning because the drugs come in, and you know you have your grandchildren, and they say to me, you know, we're not on drugs, but if we wanted drugs, they're
easy, available. Easy. Absolutely.
So it has not stopped the presence of drugs. It's raised the price somewhat, but it's given a big incentive to the people who are in the business of selling to get people addicted.
Well, it's raised the price, so it's raised the profits for those who manage to stay out of any you know, jail
time. The whole thing being criminalized extends the criminal network.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I had two experiences when I was Secretary of State. One in Colombia and one in Mexico. I went to the inauguration of a new president in each case. In both cases, the president spoke English easily. So after the inauguration, I had a meeting with them, and there was nobody else present, just two people, new president and me. No interpreters, nothing. In both cases, they said the same thing. They said, "We know that you're anxious to have us work with you to prevent the drugs from coming to the United States, and we do a lot of it here. And I want to pledge to you that we will work at it very hard. But you should know that we are not the problem. You are the problem. And your demand for drugs is ruining our country because of money that these people have. They have more guns than our armed forces have and our police forces have. And we'll cooperate with you. We just wish you'd get control of the demand for drugs in your country."
Okay. No. Okay.
And then I had an experience with Nancy Reagan that was very interesting.
Right.
She was invited to speak to the United Nations about her views on the drug issue. And you know, she had her Just Say No campaign.
Right,
she
know.
Focused on the demand for drugs and how terrible it was.
Right.
So she had this draft speech, and she intended to say that in the speech. And the War on Drugs bureaucracy sort of rose up and said, "You can't say that. If you say that, no other country will cooperate with us, and it's just, you just can't have it." Mm-hmm. And she'd come to me, and I said, "You're right, stick with it." And so she did. She was like her husband. She was a very strong, she had views, and she stuck to them. So the day comes for her to give this speech. We are up at the United Nations, and she said, "Well, when do you think we should arrive?" I think she was scheduled to speak at 11:30 or something like that. And I said, "Well, if we get there at 11 o'clock, that's plenty of time. Settle in." And she said, "Oh, George, if I expect other people to come and listen to me, I should go and listen to them. So why don't we go at 10 o'clock? And I said, "Well, that's a little early, but anyway, if you want to go, we'll go." So we go to this hall, and there's practically nobody there. And she looks around at me, and she has these big brown eyes that are very compelling, sort of teary-eyed. She says, "George, doesn't anybody want to hear what I have to say?" She was heartbroken. And I said, not knowing what I was talking about, I said, "Don't worry, Nancy, when it's your turn to speak, this place will be jammed." Well, that's the way it turned out. The place was jammed. And she said what she said. "And in this particular UN forum, you spoke from your seat. And then there was a sort of a recess. And anybody from any of the countries who were there who wanted to come and comment on your speech would come by. And you sat there and you heard their comment." That was their style. So she gave her speech, and then country after country all over the world came and said, "We're so glad that you said that about the demand for drugs in the United States. And that makes us really more than ever wanting to cooperate with you. because you showed that at least you understand the problem. So it had exactly the opposite effect of the bureaucracy, but once again, she spotted the problem.
Absolutely. Well, I think we've gotten a lot of interesting comments from you on a variety of topics, George. We could continue this for a long time, but thank you very much.
Thank you, Gary.